Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 218, Lifestyle Update and an Ode to Landscape Motion Intensity and Physiology. We're doing a little different thing today. Having wandered our way through a few thousand years, it's time to reflect on a few other things. How did people go about their day-to-day lives? What was life really like by the mid-19th century in South Africa? This period was dominated by agriculture. It was before the discoveries of the most valuable minerals that turned the region from a sleepy agrarian backwater into one of the most dynamic economies in the world. Cape Town had been the fulcrum around which all European expansion rotated. The southern tip of Africa had to be navigated by all the empires of Europe, first the Portuguese, then the Dutch, then the English. So naturally, Cape Town had developed quite a sense of self-importance. Some vicious and malicious Johannesburgers claim it continues to suffer from a superiority complex today. All in good spirit, of course. It was a distant port, and if a voortrekker or an AmaZulu king travelled to Cape Town overland, it was like setting sail into an insecure future. The slow wagons cruising overland from the Waterberg to Cape Town took about as long as the maritime trip from Liverpool to Cape Town, 2 to 3 months. Both routes, whether land or sea, were rife with danger. During this perilous chapter of history, seafaring was still a high-risk venture. Meanwhile, those who braved the land faced their own litany of dangers. Wagons toppled on treacherous trails. Lions prowled the edges of camps. Venomous snakes struck without warning. Bandits lurked in the shadows. The veld itself, like the capricious ocean, seemed to conspire against the traveller, offering up a relentless gauntlet of threats to navigate. To journey across the vast, untamed veld in the mid-19th century was to set sail upon a sea of grass and dust. The land rolled endlessly like a restless ocean, its winds whispering like waves against the canvas. Travellers on horseback, on foot, or aboard creaking ox wagons were sailors of the interior, navigating invisible currents, scanning horizons as one would a shoreline, and trusting instinct over the poor maps of the day. Each mountain pass a headland, each dry riverbed a treacherous strait. To cross such distances was not merely to travel, but to voyage. A test of endurance and imagination, where the earth itself became both compass and adversary. This experience meant the journeymen and women were hardy, a tough breed. Most actually walked the trip, sometimes riding their horses, mostly leading the oxen as the wagons creaked and squeaked, rumbled and tinkled over rocky landscape. African migrants walked from the Transorangia and deeper into what is now Botswana, all the way to Cape Town to work on farms. That took weeks, sometimes months. AmaZulu kings like Shaka thought nothing of walking 300 kilometres to visit his distant homesteads, taking a fortnight to recon his land. In one stint, he walked almost 1,000 kilometres over a few weeks, checking on his kingdom. Physiology was different. People had straighter spines at this time in world history. There were fewer eye problems, stronger limbs. But they lived shorter lives in general. Medicine was a distant luxury for most. 19th century South Africans, like many pre-industrial populations globally, generally had better postural alignment and physical conditioning compared to sedentary modern denizens of the Ethernet. Throughout this period, both African and settler communities in southern Africa were highly active by necessity. Transportation was limited to the walking, horseback riding, or ox-drawn wagons, requiring people to travel long distances on foot or in motion-intensive ways. At home, people didn't just sit around reading Instagram. They had to draw water, cut wood, fix a tool, prepare food from scratch, harvest a vegetable garden, butcher the sheep. You, some would say. If you needed to get somewhere, it was all about the body. Even riding in a wagon wasn't passive. You'd be jolted along rough tracks, holding on, constantly adjusting position. Everything involved movement. Daily life required your body to be active, constantly in motion, whether walking long distances or riding, herding animals, or even working with your hands. There were very few passive activities. There was no electricity. Ethnographic and missionary accounts from that era, such as those by Dr. David Livingstone or Thomas Baines, frequently remark on the exceptional physical endurance of local populations. Many African societies, particularly among pastoralist and hunter-gatherer communities like the San, the Tswana, and the Amazulu, were noted for their upright posture and ease of movement over long distances and difficult terrain. The strength needed to walk along the tracks and slopes of southern Africa is well known. The pursuit is replicated today with all the wonderful trails around the countryside. Anthropologists and anatomists have long studied skeletal remains from pre-modern populations across Africa, including southern Africa, and noted fewer spinal abnormalities than are commonly found today. For example, Dr. Esther Gokhale of NASA has done work on posture across traditional societies which are not specific to southern Africa. She found straighter spines, better aligned vertebrae, and a lack of slumping shoulders. While her work has been popularized in posture therapy, it draws on photographic and observational studies of traditional walking and carrying methods, particularly head loading, which is still practiced in South Africa and the rest of the continent. This method helps build spinal integrity, muscular balance, mainly women carrying heavy loads on their heads. It is often referred to by developmental advocates as abusive practice against women. Ironically, the twin physiological effect is positive. Skeletal studies such as those compiled in the South African Journal of Science have examined the remains from 18th and 19th century burial sites and found low incidence of degenerative spinal conditions like kyphosis and lordosis. Kyphosis is an abnormal outward curvature of the spine, often leading to a rounded back, and the worst case scenario is a hunchback. Lordosis is the excessive inward curve of the spine, typically lower back to lumbar, or in the neck, the cervical spine. The active lifestyle, farming, herding, walking long distances, appears to have contributed to overall stronger musculoskeletal systems. In contrast, 20th and 21st century populations show increasing sedentism, especially in urban settings. We slouch towards digital absolution, clutching our devices with claw-like hands, hunched in self-appointed urgency while the real world churns around us. We peer through thickening spectacle lenses into a distant digital realm, absorbed in the illusion of importance as reality drifts further from our grasp. Based on ethnographic records, photographic evidence, skeletal analysis, and comparative anatomical studies, it is accurate to say that many 19th century Southern Africans had straighter backs, better posture, and greater physical endurance than their descendants, rugby players or not. But it wasn't all milk and honey, of course. The fatality rate remained high until the end of the 19th century, although in South Africa, people were generally living longer than in parts of Europe. There's a great deal of information about this. Sources include Norman Etherington, Schuler Marx, a host of others, Reed, Manning, Aleph, and yet some of the data is murky. The reason why the average life expectancy was so low is that infant mortality rate was off the charts high, around 200 per thousand births, black or white, and this pulled the overall life expectancy average down. To give you an idea of just how awful that rate is, it's now 24 deaths per 1,000 births in South Africa. Back in the mid-19th century, if you managed to make it past 25 by some miracle, most continued to survive past 50. So the numbers don't tell the complete story. Africans in healthy rural settings and settlers living in relatively stable farming or pastoral communities lived well past 60, some into their 90s, or even the hundreds. We can go further using these various sources to sum up the likely life expectancy mid-19th century. In the Cape Colony, Dutch and English farmers on average lived to 45, while Khoisan and Amaxhosa lived to 40. In Natal, the Nguni people and the settlers both averaged around 40, while in the Boer republics it was 45. The San, on the other hand, were much more likely to succumb at an earlier age, 35. While indentured labourers were also likely to die by 35. So too, the urban poor in Cape Town, Port Elizabeth, Grahamstown. Average life expectancy there for the working class, 35. On mission stations, life expectancy rose to 45. So it's a rather patchy combination of expectancies, backed up by graveyard archaeology, baptism records, burial records, ethnographic studies, etc. Just to provide some spice in this mix, I read the journals of the time, which are all illuminating. Take Sophia Pigott, for example, an 1820s settler, who described an average day in 1857, 30 years after she arrived. She moved from Grahamstown into Natal. She had married and was now Sophia Moody, wife of Donald Moody, a man of political influence. Sophia and Donald were semi-retired in 1857, living on their farm Doornkop, outside Ladysmith. It was not unusual for Sophia, in her late 50s, to take the 160-kilometre horseback journey from Doornkop to Maritzburg and back. In one case, she did so in pouring rain all the way there and pretty much all the way back. Here's an extract from the trip from her journal. Left Emgeni River to Moy River, rain. Crossed Bushman's River in a horrid box. Horse nearly strangled. Box nearly upset. Quite frightened, but hoped to be home in a few hours. Thunderstorm. Turned back. Went to Nixon's. That was a friend of hers. Rain all day. River full. Next day, set out, tried to cross Little Bushman's River high up. Rode a long way. Could not cross. Began to pour with rain. Got quite wet. Borrowed Mrs. Nixon's clothes. Next day, Nixon took beams to the river. We crossed. Still rain. Got to Doornkop. Very tired. And a bad boil. Next day, ill with boil. Now it was Sunday 15th. Your journal went. Went to prayers. Praying the boil away, perhaps. Her trip started on January 5th. She arrived home on January 8th. 3 days of travel to cover the measly 160 kilometres. Almost drowning, wet, and then ill with a boil. There were better ways to get about, but wagons were hellish expensive. Southern African wagon builders, or mechanics, as they were known, had great skill. When wagons or horse-drawn carriages were available, these were the five-star transport of the era, as artist William Burchell noted. The principal and very important advantage of a Cape-built wagon consists in its sides, bottom and carriage, not being joined together, a construction admirably well adapted for rough and uneven roads. By admitting each part to play freely so as completely to avoid that straining and cracking to which solid-built wagons are subjected when travelling over uneven ground. Independent suspension of the day, 4x4 logic, one wheel up, the other down, the carriage bending and twisting, not breaking. Impressive innovations. Full of arms and ammunition, barrels of salted meat, bags of flour, tea, coffee, spare clothes to wear if Mr. Nixon wasn't around, and to barter with the locals, carpenter's tools, water casks, fish hooks, lines, medicines, books, packing cases, a couple of dogs. Like a ship sailing into the unknown, drifting across the veld, taking the direct route using compass, led by an experienced guide. In the early 1860s, the journey from the Cape Colony to Transorangia, particularly to destinations like Bloemfontein or the Maloti foothills, was a formidable undertaking. Overland travel between Cape Town and the Orange Free State could span upwards of 1,000 kilometres depending on the route taken, often through the Karoo's dry flats, over treacherous rivers into the escarpment. With ox-drawn wagons averaging just 15 to 25 kilometres a day in favourable conditions, this journey could easily take 6 to 10 weeks, weather and terrain permitting. Colonial travellers documented the hardships vividly. In his journals, Burchell also wrote of tiresome days of jolting and straining over the sun-cracked earth, where every thorn bush seemed bent on tearing man and beast alike. Thomas Baines noted how wagon wheels splintered on stone-strewn slopes and how draft oxen staggered under their yokes as the highveld opened before him. Yet these accounts miss the deeper story of the African men and women who made such journeys not once, but repeatedly, and mostly on foot, for the Xhosa-speaking people of the Eastern Cape, particularly the Amanxika and the Amandlambe, Migrant labour to the western districts of the Cape and northwards across the Orange River became an increasingly common seasonal rhythm after the cattle killings of the late 1850s and the loss of their land. Young men walked from the Kai River to farms and towns as far afield as Wellington and Beaufort West. The distances were punishing. From the lower Kai to Cape Town, the route exceeds 1,200 kilometres. Oral histories record that such a journey could take a month on foot, longer if the rivers were in flood or horses could not be borrowed. Khoisan pastoralists and hunters, some still semi-nomadic in the interior during this time, were also drawn into this web of motion. From their base in the arid interior of the Northern Cape or the Gariep region, many walked to the same western agricultural towns for short-term work or herded livestock for colonial farmers in the borderlands. Their endurance is often remarked upon in settler writing, though seldom with empathy. Magistrate John Phillip, for example, in 1863, who said, "Fleet-footed, their souls hardened like hooves by the stony flats, able to pass over lands where no wagon could go." Among the Basutu, whose territory had recently been demarcated by Moshoeshoe in the shadow of imperial interference, the 1860s brought both hardship and ingenuity. Young men journeyed to Grahamstown and the Cape's urban centres. Many travelled barefoot over the Drakensberg's ridges and then westward, often walking 500 to 800 kilometres in stages. Their journeys were undertaken with the support of village networks. Food was shared along the way, resting places known to seasoned travellers, and these were reused year after year. But the risks were real. Attacks by bandits, disease, and the sheer physical toll of the journey loomed large. The migrations by now were a necessity. For many, these were journeys of survival. In the Eastern Cape, the aftermath of colonial wars and the devastation of the cattle killing meant that families could not subsist on farming alone. Young Amaxhosa men left to find wages and returned with items prized in the rural homestead: blankets, tools, horses, clothing, sometimes guns. For the Basutu, long-distance travel was a response to both overpopulation in the fertile valleys and the pressure from encroaching colonial powers. Labour migration became a rite of passage, both as a means to adult status and a survival strategy. It was a mark of honour, a reinforcement of kingship. Wanderers motivated by survival, memories transferred. The people who navigated the landscape were duty-bound, and their travel wasn't measured in kilometres and months, but in meaning. This episode has been largely comprised of an ode to motion intensity, migration, the start of something in South African history that goes on to this day. Our ancestors didn't need to go to gym every day. Most of their daily life encompassed intense activity, straining every sinew, strengthening their bodies, testing their wills. Next episode, we're back to 1861 and 62. A new Cape governor has arrived, Sir Philip Wodehouse, a civilian, the first non-military governor since the British seized the Cape in 1805. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platform. It helps elevate visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load updates about these episodes. You can email me from there too. Until next, bon voyage.